Good evening, one and all. My name is Emily Towns, and I'm the Dean of the Vanderbilt Divinity School, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here this evening. Also, to those who are watching us live stream and will also see these lectures in the archives, a welcome to you as well to the 2016 Cole Lectureship. This lectureship was established in 1893 by Colonel E.W. Cole of Nashville to bring distinguished lecturers to the campus in, as the indenture of this lectureship says, defense and advocacy of the Christian religion, close quote. As we have now turned into the 21st century, we are broadening this once again to include engagement, conversation, and shared deliberation that abounds in the concerns that the Christian traditions might share with other faiths. Among the distinguished church leaders and theologians who have delivered the Cole Lectures over the last 123 years are Harry Emerson Fosdick, Paul Tillich, H. Richard Niebuhr, Fred Craddock, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, Albert Rabiteau, Gustavo Gutierrez, James Cone, Ed Farley, David Buttrick, Jürgen Moltmann, Peter Gomes, Jim Wallace, James Lawson, Elaine Pagels, and then last year we had a poet, Nikki Finney. This year's Cole Lectures are part of the Transformative Justice, Culture, Race, and Movement series, a partnership between Vanderbilt Divinity School and Skerrett Bennett Center that offers laity and clergy the opportunity to explore different ways to combine leadership development through justice making, through lectures by poets and writers, workshops on social change, other artistic media, and even a civil rights immersion. This partnership draws on expertise of both institutions and their historic commitments to offer people of faith resources for building a more just and faithful culture. Dr. Ingrid Mattson is the London and Windsor Community Chair in Islamic Studies at Huron University. My watch is beeping at me and telling me there's an emergency. There is no emergency. Excuse me. Dr. Mattson was educated in Canada and the United States, earning a PhD from the University of Chicago in 1999. From 1998 to 2012, she was professor of Islamic studies at Hartford Seminary in Connecticut, where she developed and directed the first accredited graduate program for Muslim chaplains in America, and served as director of the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Christian-Muslim Relations. From 2001 to 2010, Dr. Mattson served as vice president, then as president, of the Islamic Society of North America, USA, the first woman to serve in either position. Her writings, both academic and public, focus primarily on Quran interpretation, Islamic theological ethics, and interfaith relations. Her book, The Story of the Quran, is an academic bestseller and was chosen by the U.S. National Endowment for the Humanities for inclusion in the Bridging Cultures program. Dr. Mattson is a senior fellow of the Royal Al-Bayat Institute for Islamic Thought in Amman, Jordan. From 2009 to 10, Dr. Mattson was a member of the Interfaith Task Force of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. In 2008, she was on the Council of Global Leaders of the C-100 of the World Economic Forum, and from from 2007 in 2008. She was a member of the leadership group of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. Dr. Madsen is the recipient of numerous awards as well as honorary doctorates from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and the Chicago Theological Seminary. She is frequently consulted by media and has served as an expert witness. Among her many awards and recognitions are Newsweek magazine's People to Watch in 2007, the El Haj Malik El Shabazz Award presented by the Washington Academic Leadership Institute, the Congressional Muslim Staffers Association, and the Muslim Society Network, January 19, 2009. The Medal of Independence of the First Order for contributions to the field of Islamic studies, Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, 2010, and Jordan's Royal Institute for Strategic Studies, as well as the 500 Influential Muslims in 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012. We welcome Dr. Madsen as this year's co-lecturer and anticipate a vibrant conversation. Tonight, the title of her lecture is The Landed Muslim, At Home on the Earth. It is my great honor and joy to welcome you back to Vanderbilt and Vanderbilt Divinity School, to this time and place and space with us. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ingrid Madsen.
Oh, good evening. May God's peace and blessings be upon you. It is such an honor to be here, back at Vanderbilt. I was here a year ago at an event sponsored by the Center for Faith and Culture called Who is My Neighbor? And saw what a welcoming and lovely place Nashville is. We all have our prejudices and our stereotypes, and you know, a lot of people in the North have certain impressions of people in the South or of the Southern U.S. And I think many people, when they come to Nashville, they realize that we all have to take a second look at our assumptions about people in different parts of the world. So I found nothing but warm welcome here, and I'm so happy to be back. I'm so honored to be part of this lecture series, the co-lectures. Thank you so much, Dean Emily Towns, for inviting me to be part of this. Greetings to all of you. Greetings, people of the future who will be watching this on the internet at various times. Who knows what our world will be like in another year or another 2 years. Feel a little bit nervous about that, frankly. I don't know how you're all feeling, but seems sometimes like we're living in a time of great anxiety and disruption and upheaval. So it's such a blessing from God when we have the opportunity to come together and talk about our desire to be together, to come together, to care about each other, to care about those people in need, to try to find a way forward that is faithful, that is loving, that is generous. We need to be those people. We need to keep these spaces vibrant and alive so this kind of language and this kind of discourse can continue. You know, when I was here last year, I spoke in particular about the challenge, one of the main challenges in our time, which is that it's so difficult to simply meet each other as neighbors because we have many preconceptions about who the other is. It's not that we never had that in the past, but perhaps naive encounters or, you know, honest kind of just fresh encounters with new people who would come into our neighborhood or our community was easier when we weren't inundated with the persistent news stream of bad news. Of course, you know, news is about what's frightening, what's scary, what's alarming, what's a threat. And we notice that. Our brains have evolved to take notice of threats more than of benign news. We remember frightening things more than we remember the happy things. Just try to remember right now about, say, some dreams you had as a child. How many of those dreams were nightmares that you can remember until today, and how many of those dreams were just pleasant? We remember frightening things, we remember scary things, and it distorts our perception of reality. There is so much research today about prejudice and bias. Why does it exist? How can it be overcome? The New York Times just yesterday, I believe, had a piece on implicit bias and how we are all biased. We all know about confirmation bias. So we're starting to learn more about how we perceive the world and the gap between reality and perception. And to that extent, science is helping us. And it's nice that at least in this area, perhaps science and religion can come together, because sometimes it seems that there's an inherent conflict or a clash, at least from some ideologues in the two communities. But here in this way, how our minds work, how we perceive the other, how we form group identity, how we filter reality through the prism of the news is something that science can help us with. But science can't give us the ethics, the ethical imperative for saying that it's necessary for us to overcome these biases. Science cannot tell us that it is a matter of justice to have to refuse to act on our stereotypes, to act on our prejudices, to act on our biases. And so here is the role for the faith community. Here is the role for the social justice community. We have to bring our ethical voice to this knowledge, to these scientific discoveries about the way the human mind works, and say, it's not okay to simply say and shrug our shoulders, well, we all have biases. Yes, we all have them, but we know, as people of faith, people of social justice, people who believe in the equal and God-given human dignity, that that's just the first step. The next step is we have to say, how do we organize ourselves? How do we listen to each other? How do we open ourselves up to each other so that we can better achieve the recognition of the God-given dignity of the other, to welcome the stranger and to live in harmony with our neighbors? I have two favorite stories from the Muslim tradition about Jesus, who is a beloved prophet in Islam, who is a role model for the Muslim community in a different way than for Christians, but certainly he is the guided word of God in our tradition. And two of these stories that come out of the oral tradition, they're not in the Quran, but they are narrated by the Prophet Muhammad about his predecessor in the prophetic tradition, Jesus. And both of them tell of a conversation between Jesus and his disciples as they walk down a road together. In the first story, Jesus and his disciples pass a pig standing in a garden. Jesus says to the pig, "Peace be upon you." His disciples, no doubt as observant Jews repulsed by the sight of a pig, ask, "Why did you say that?" Jesus said, I do not want my tongue to become accustomed to harsh words. In the second story, Jesus and his disciples pass by a dead dog lying at the side of the road. Jesus points to the canine carcass, which of course, again, according to Jewish law, is unclean, and says, "Look, what nice white teeth he has." Some people say that religious people are too idealistic, or that people involved in interfaith activities are Pollyannas. This is wrong. We know there is much evil in the world. Life is a struggle, and often very, very sad. But what Jesus and the righteous throughout the ages have taught us is to see beauty in the midst of ugliness, and that how we respond to and speak to and about the less than pleasant things in the world determines who we are. In this regard, the Quran says, "Do not let the hatred of others towards you let you deviate from justice. Do not let the hatred of others for you let you deviate from justice." I remember it was 2001 or 2002, I was interviewed by Krista Tippett, who has a radio program. Now it's called On Being, and in those days it was called Speaking of Faith. And she asked me what were my anxieties and concerns about the future for the Muslim community in the wake of 9/11 and everything that happened after that. And of course, there were many things to be concerned about, but I told her what I was most worried about was the fact that inevitably, there would be an increase in hatred or discrimination against Muslims, and we've seen that. It's much worse now than it ever was before. But it's not that hatred that I was so worried about. I was more worried about what that would do to us. Because when you are attacked, when you are unjustly accused of actions for which you're not responsible, when you regularly experience discrimination, especially as a young person in your formation, it can't help but affect your perception of who you are. And the most natural reaction is to strike back. You know, someone strikes you and you want to strike back. Someone attacks you and you want to lash out against them. You know, someone yells something ignorant at you as they're driving down the street and you loosen your tongue and a few choice words are raised in the wake of that truck that's driving quickly away. It concerns me, and it concerns me that indeed what has happened is that there has been such pressure and such a need to defend ourselves that in some cases it doesn't give us the space to think about the ways in which we also need to reform ourselves. We need the time for self-reflection. We are not always the person in the room who has it most difficult. And we all have multiple aspects to our being. I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow in the lecture I'm giving about perspective. But I've certainly noticed this because I'm not just a Muslim, I'm a white person. And what I have noticed and what I've learned that all white people need to learn is that yes, we too have a culture and we too have a series of identity markers. Although we try very hard to project ourselves as neutral, but there is no neutrality in humanity. And it's very interesting to me that, yes, in some cases, there may be an initial slight against me as a Muslim. I wear a headscarf, so I'm identifiable as a Muslim. But in most cases, after that initial unspoken encounter, when I begin to speak to people, to white people, to the privileged class of Canada and the United States, they see me as one of them. And white identity is very, very powerful. It's almost powerful enough to wash away some of the religious prejudice or some of the cultural prejudice. So that's a very sobering lesson to me, because I have to then make the second move of examining myself, not only seeing my identity through the collective identity of my religious community and say, I need to defend my community, I need to stand up for my community, but I also need to recognize I am part of another collectivity that is in a position of extreme privilege and also domination in many cases. So it is humbling indeed. I am by nature a very calm person, but in the last 15 years, as the news rolled in, news of terrorism and torture, I found myself often so very angry. The only way to describe how I feel even today about the terrorist attacks of 9/11 is white hot rage. I was in New York on September 10th this year, and just thinking about what happened, I was living in Connecticut in 2001, made me so very angry. But over the last 15 years, when the heat of my anger would dissipate, I would think, now what? Now what do I do about that? The truth is that whenever I was moved to act on that anger, I would often find that others had already begun responding. Terrorism in the name of Islam, so offensive to me, to take the thing that is most precious to me, my faith, and to use it to justify murder and terrorism and genocide. How horrible, how shameful. But when I'd look around, I would find many colleagues, from the most distinguished Muslim scholars across the world to my friends and moms and dads and young people, doing anything they could to denounce the sickness, issuing statements, organizing groups. But then what to do about the reaction to this? What about US-sponsored torture, which, you know, I had just a sick feeling in my stomach every time I read about what happened. Well, again, God's grace came forward and brought someone like Princeton Professor George Hunsinger, who founded the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, who launched a vigorous and sustained ethical response to this issue. Every time I would hear something, you know, about a mosque being burnt or a Quran being burnt or thrown in the trash, my Christian and Jewish colleagues from across the country would hold press conferences denouncing the action, and even would hold Quran readings in response, courageous and generous acts of love. Some people complain that interfaith programs are too much about people being nice to each other. My response is that there is much substantial work that has been done in the name and through interfaith engagement. And besides, perhaps being nice is somewhat underrated. In the last decade, vulgar, mean, and slanderous attacks, whether politically partisan or religiously informed, have become all too acceptable. A kind word, a smiling face, the benefit of the doubt, a listening ear, these are the postures the faith community should retain and continue to model for the rest of society. The Prophet Muhammad said that when one stays in the company of people who are speaking in a vulgar and bad way, it's like being in a smoky, sooty blacksmith shop. One walks away feeling a little dirty and smelly. But when one stays in the company of people who are speaking in a good way about good things, with language full of love and compassion, it's like being in a room filled with incense, and the pleasant scent lingers on one's person throughout the day. I'm not all that delicate, but sometimes I think it really stinks out there. Like the perfumed handkerchief a Victorian lady might hold under her nose as she walked around the open sewers flowing through the streets of London, the pleasant, kind and loving religious congregations who have opened their doors to me in the last decade have made it possible for me to breathe and continue to move forward. So some people believe that there is a choice only between fidelity to one's faith tradition and deep fellowship, or one's faith tradition, or leaving faith altogether. But I believe that's a false dichotomy. Deep fellowship with people of other faiths is another layer of identity that we can add onto our religious identity. I think of it like a family. I have a large nuclear family, 7 siblings in my house. But we also have a large extended family. I've got lots of cousins and aunts and uncles, and I don't even know whether they're second or third, or, you know, once, twice removed, or what it is. But I just know there's an awful lot of them. And while I spend most of my time with my brothers and sisters born from the same mother and father, I also go and visit those other families sometimes. And I also have some things in common, not as much, but some things. And we know that somewhere back there, we all come from the same place. Why did God give us all of this diversity? You know, religious diversity, cultural diversity, linguistic, ethnic. Are our collective identities necessarily a source of conflict? Would it be better if we were all just the same? Well, which same would that be then? Whose same would get to be the one we all are? That's the problem, isn't it? I really find so much inspiration in the Quranic view of diversity. The Quran came as a revelation to humanity, and it also came as a revelation to a people, a specific people in a specific time and place, and spoke, you know, in addition to universal human needs, to the needs of those people at that time. 7th century Arabia was a time when collective identities were a source of great strength, but also a source of great conflict. If you belonged to a member of a tribe, you knew who you were. You knew who your people were. You knew what you had to do. You knew that they would always have your back and that you would do anything to defend them. But the problem was, what about people from that other group? Without any overarching or unifying sense of human rights or human dignity, it meant you could do whatever you wanted with them. There were no limits whatsoever. What do we do with each other? When it comes to religious diversity, the Quran, some could say, is very strongly in favor of religious diversity, and I think there could be no better proof than the passage of the Quran that mentions in a few places in a similar way this statement: those who believe in God and the last day, the Jews and the Sabians and the Christians, those who believe in God in the last day and do righteous deeds, they will have their reward with God. They shall not fear, nor shall they sorrow. The recognition, the Quran came with the recognition that there are different religious communities. It didn't come to wipe the slate clean, to get rid of all other faiths or beliefs, but to come into that world of religious diversity, to uphold it, and to be part of it. Many people say religion is the source of the greatest conflict in the world. They're incorrect. I mean, historically, it's just not true. It can be a source of conflict, but it can also be a source of strength, and we know what the purpose is, because God tells us in the Quran, "For each we have made a law and a creed." If God had wanted, He could have made you a single community. But it is His will to test you regarding what has been revealed to you. So compete with each other in good deeds. To God is your return, all of you. Then we, God using the royal we, will inform you about those things about which you differed. So there's a point to our religious diversity. The point is that through the other, we can see in a spirit of kind of friendly competitiveness where we're falling short. Only compete in good deeds, not in a bad way, and within the limits of this world that God has set for us. We're never going to know all the answers, and this is why we have that faith that God will inform us in the end about all these matters that we differed about. Our job is to do good things, to compete and to cooperate in good works. There are those who have interpreted the Quran other ways, who have made religion into a form of tribalism like other forms of tribalism, who see religious identity as another identity that we simply engage in the political sphere, the, you know, competition over who's best, over who's right. The question is this inevitable? Does religion always have to devolve into this kind of unsightly and unpleasant conflict? Some would say that what's necessary is that we embrace a theological pluralism or a perennialism even, that unless we absolutely accept that every religion is an equal path to God, then we'll always be in conflict. And I don't know, I think that's it's a factual claim. Can there be people who have a theological exclusivistic outlook and still uphold equal human dignity, human rights, and citizenship? I wonder. I remember assigning an essay to my students one time, and in the classroom I had a woman who was an evangelical Christian who certainly believed that there is only one path to salvation with God. She was a lovely student. She participated so nicely in the class. At the beginning of the essay that she wrote for me, she said, well, certainly it's true that Muslims, they're on the wrong path, that there is salvation only through Jesus Christ, and unless those Muslims embrace Jesus in this way as their Lord and Savior, that they're going to be in hellfire forever. It's a brave student who would start an essay that way. She said, but in the meantime, you know, that matters for God. In the meantime, we need to try to live together as peacefully and in as much harmony and understanding as possible. And I just laugh so much. I love that essay. I just love that essay. Because you know what? She was a nice person. She is a nice person. And she got along with everyone. And I don't think she ever would take away my civil or political rights. So maybe it's possible to have, you know, that kind of theological position. It's probably easier if there's a greater harmony between our theological view of humanity and political, perhaps. But some would say it's easier just to get rid of religion altogether. But again, I ask you, in a world where many nation states have adopted a secular ideology, in the 20th century, when we review the wars and conflicts, when we think about the genocides that have taken place, Nazi Germany, Rwanda, how many other places? How often were those done in the names of ethnic purity, racial purity? Secularism, nationalism hasn't erased prejudice or ended warfare or ended torture. We still have all sorts of things going on in the world, group identities that are simply oppressive, that have nothing to do with religion. So group identity is a double-edged sword. There's good and there's bad in it. Think about the various groups to which we belong, not just religious, but national or professional, neighborhood associations, civic organizations, political parties. All have some benefit. They give us a cause greater than ourselves. And really, here is this existential dimension that as human beings, we know that we have a limited time on this earth. We all want some measure of living forever, some measure of eternity, some measure of ourselves continuing on. And so we see our aspirations, we see our identity conflated with these groups that will continue the actions, the ideas that belong and that shape this group identity. But this can lead to such a problem. The problem is that it becomes really what we worship, where our group becomes the idol at which we sacrifice everything. The pre-Islamic Arabs, before Islam came, knew about this. They had very strong group identity. They knew that the most important thing was to sacrifice the self for the sake of the group. There were no rights outside of those granted by the leaders of the tribe. Safety for anyone else was only negotiated and contracted, not innate. It was might that made right. And in a world where might makes right, it is the warrior who is the most celebrated. That is why the strong, mature man, the adult male, is the one who had all the privileges in this tribal culture, in this warrior culture. And it was that man who would use force and violence to make sure that they were the dominant ones. There have always been those who have spoken about winners and losers. That those who succeed are the winners. That being right just means that you were successful. And what does that mean for all of those who are not in that group, or those who are within the group but unable or not permitted to perform at that level? Women, slaves, the unaffiliated person, the stranger, the migrant. But we argue we have an identity in our group, and we love our group, we love our people, we love our community, we love our nation. Muhammad Iqbal, who was a 19th into the 20th century Indian Muslim philosopher and intellectual, he was one of the people who advocated for the establishment of Pakistan as a nation state, as a modern nation state. And it wasn't because of religious prejudice that he did this, but because they were a minority in India. The Muslims were a minority, and he felt that it was so important to really uphold the, not only the security of that group, but to celebrate and pass on the traditions and culture. He said, "I love the communal group, which is the source of my life and behavior, and which has formed me, what I am, by giving me its religion, its literature, its thought, its culture, and thereby recreating its whole past as a living operative factor in my present consciousness." Well, Pakistan was formed, and having that communal identity did not end the problems. Like every other nation state, and indeed, the founding of nation states based on identity, based on these mythic, collective histories and memories, has only exacerbated in many places the injustice, because you never have a land that is homogeneous. You know, only with one kind of person. How do we get around this? We have to remember that these collectivities are not ends in themselves. These identities are not the thing that we worship. We cannot let our religion become another form of tribalism. It's beneficial in many ways, but it is always creates the possibility for an ideological collectivity. The Quran addresses human diversity, not only religious diversity, but all of these other forms of being in the world that are at the border of our conflicts and our pain and of our oppression. The Quran says, "And among his wonders is this," meaning God's wonders, "he creates you out of dust, and then lo, you become human beings ranging far and wide. And among his wonders is this, he creates for you mates from your own selves, so that you might incline towards them, and he engenders love and tenderness between you. In this, behold, are messages for people who think, and among his wonders is the creation of the heavens and the earth and the diversity of your tongues and colors. For in this, behold, there are messages indeed for all who are possessed of innate knowledge." The diversity of our colors, our languages, all of these things are created by God. It's just simply part of the natural world. We have to accept that we are part of this nature. Yes, we are not only human beings, we were also created beings, and like other created beings, are all subject to the command of God. The Quran says, "Behold, people, we have created you out of a male and a female and have made you into nations and tribes so that you may come to know one another. Our diversity helps us understand who we are. We see ourselves reflected in the other. And when I meet you and I treat you in a way that is loving and caring, I come to know myself as a loving and caring person. And when I meet you and I meet the other and treat the other in a way that is dismissive, that is aggressive, that is discriminatory, I come to know something about myself too." We can never escape being in these collectivities. We need them. We need to gather together. We need to support each other. But they're not, in the end, ends in themselves. In his final sermon, the Prophet Muhammad said, "All humanity is from Adam and Eve. An Arab has no superiority over a non-Arab, nor a non-Arab has any superiority over an Arab. And also a white has no superiority over a black or a black over a white." We hear that and we know that, yet it's so hard for us to do the right thing still. We are flawed human beings and we need to be open to that criticism, to understand when we have simply fallen back to the safety and security of our group. The American poet Daniel Ledinsky translates a poem of the great 14th century Persian master poet Hafiz. He says this, "Burn every address for God, any beloved who has just one color of hair, one gender, one race, the same suntan all the time, one rule book. Trust me when I say that man is not even half a god, and we will only cause you grief." We make gods out of our collectivities. But in the end, even though we gather in certain lands and we come to love those lands and the people around us, the reality is that human dignity is tied to mobility, to displacement, to breaking up our collectivities and coming and being open to joining with new people and working for their safety and security in the midst of the dignity of all humanity. The Quran says, "We have conferred dignity upon the children of Adam and borne them over land and sea and provided them sustenance out of the good things of life and favored them above much of our creation." Humanity has always been on the move from the time that our ancestors first moved out of Africa and all across into Asia and across into Europe and across into North America and South America and the Pacific and Australia and New Zealand. We're always moving and we're always finding ways to expand ourselves and we're always coming into contact with new kinds of people. And it can be anxiety producing. We want to just go back to the warmth of our home, our mother's house, our place where we grew up. We have, as human beings, landscapes of the soul. This is an expression that my Ukrainian professor of classical Arabic poetry, Yaroslav Stekevich, wonderful, brilliant man at the University of Chicago, he spoke about and wrote about in one of his books. He talks about Arcadia, that for the Greco-Roman poets of antiquity is the landscape of the soul. So too, in every culture and in every community, there is that that landscape that's tied to memory and family, homeland. And it becomes a symbol of the purity of youth. It becomes a symbol of the warmth and comfort of home. And that's natural. But we have to grow up. We have to grow up and remember that there is no way back onto our mother's lap. We have to become adults, and it's time for us to take responsibility for building new homes and for us to be the one who cooks for the neighbor and invites them in. There are a lot of challenges today. You know, it's not a difficult time, but I'm sure that people who lived 100 years ago or 200 or 500 or 1,000 years ago, if they heard us complaining, they'd say, boy, oh boy, you think you've got it tough. So at the same time, we have to be so grateful to God for the time we have, for the resources we have, for what our ancestors have built, civil rights, human rights, all of the things that so many have fought for so that we could come to this place today and still deal with our humanity, still deal with it. We're never over. We're always in the process of becoming the people who we need to be. And we will never be perfected until, God willing, we are in the presence of the divine and most compassionate and loving source of all being. But in the meantime, let's try to reflect that compassion and reflect that kindness and be like the prophets. Address what's wrong, but don't let it change us and we become distorted mirrors of ourselves. Thank you. I believe we have a little time for discussion now, and Ms. Shatika is going to bring around a microphone if you wish to make a comment or ask a question. And just because I said we should be careful how we speak, you can say something if you have a hard question or something that's disturbing you, please feel free to speak. It's a safe space for discussion.
Assalamu alaikum. So a lot of what you talked about was the process through which particularly looking at the Muslim community, how we should not respond to hate with hate. I had recently read or reread Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail, where he says the first step, in this case particularly for nonviolent non-cooperation, is self-purification. Mm-hmm. So now I can say, okay, my first step is not to respond to hate with hate. But how does that then actualize in a process of self-purification?
Yeah, that's a great question. Here, and I'm going to speak about it a little bit more tomorrow, it really is, I think one of the most effective things is to shift perspective. So to look at ourselves, who we are in all of our being. And there's not one of us that is not in a position of power or dominance over someone or something, right? So when we suffer from the dominance of others or from the oppression of others, that is a lesson in a human state that we all occupy sometimes. And so rather than seeing the evil only outside ourselves, we have to examine ourselves, closely examine ourselves, what in me is also part of that way of being in the world. You know, we are parents, we are employers, we are pet owners, you know, we are people who are empowered in the world, no matter how much of our reality is about being, you know, or we perceive to be dominated by others. And so when we look that way, when we take this action, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, when you see someone who has more, look to someone who has less. So it's this double action. I see the one who has more power, more voice, more dominance, and then I make the shift. I look this way and I turn the other way and I say, who has less than me? Because there will be always someone who has not only more stuff, but more power than me, more privilege than me, more voice than me. And I have to turn the other way and look for those who have less. And when I do that, what I'm probably going to find is a deeper level of structural violence, a deeper level of structural injustice that is, you know, that provides the foundation for all of us to be in this state where we're not able to realize our full humanity and dignity. And so it's not a question of pragmatism that I'm just making an alliance with another group in order to strengthen my group, right, in order to strengthen the voice of my group, but to really understand at a much deeper level that we're all participating in forms of violence that we need to dismantle at the deepest level.
Thank you. Maybe just on that last point, doesn't conflict begin when brother rises up against brother, even before we break into different groups? Right in the very core of the family, you have Cain and Abel in the Bible. I think in Islamic tradition, it's, you know, very early on, there is that kind of fratricidal splitting, factioning. Isn't that at the origin even of the, you know, the Shiite? And so I just wonder to what extent your comments, which are, you know, extremely attractive, and, you know, the need to accept difference, is that going to address the roots of violence where even same and same are already in a conflict situation with one another?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you're getting to the heart of what it means to be a human being. A human being who in the end is aware at some level, maybe only unconsciously, that we don't have control. We don't have power. And this is, I believe, the root of violence. The root of violence is the need to feel empowered, because in the end, we're all losers if winning means to be in control, because we'll all die, right? So this is why the question about what the goal of our existence is so important. In the Quranic story, when the two brothers the two sons of Adam are in disagreement, the one who ends up being killed says to his brother, if you will stretch out your hand towards me in violence, I will not stretch my hand out towards you. He did not want to take on that sin, and so this accords with this Quranic passage that do not let the hatred of others let you swerve from justice. So to be just yourself, that this is the most, this is the primordial challenge. You know, we feel not only disempowered, but we feel that people don't recognize our dignity. And if we go back even deeper or earlier than the sons of Adam, we could go to Satan and Adam, the very creation of the world, the creation of sentient beings. So in the Quranic story, why is Satan so angry? Satan is angry because he believes that God unjustly, unfairly gave humanity, gave Adam precedence in creation when he was better. So in the Quran, Satan says, I'm better than him. I am better than him. Now, the problem is that, you know, our very beings, of course, wouldn't exist without God's creation. So it's this sense of being entitled to life, being entitled to power, being entitled to position, where when at the very beginning, at the very foundation, we wouldn't even have existence if God hadn't willed us into existence. So the sense of entitlement and the feeling that the recognition that in the end none of this is in our control are the two basic stages that bring us to acts of violence. And let me just say finally, this is why, you know, the comment about self-purification, we hear sometimes people say, no peace without justice, right? Or no justice without peace. Certainly the spiritual position is that while we work for justice, our peace does not depend on justice. The root, you know, the basic root for Islam is related to peace. It's a surrender to the reality that God has determined. And so while we struggle for justice, it is always within the limits of what it means to be a person at peace with what God has determined in the universe. And so that really, you know, it's not anything that any Muslim person should be chanting. That's a real deviation, and I think that comes out of a kind of activist politics that is devoid of spiritual training and our spiritual tradition of self-purification, which has often been lost in the modern world and is so important to be regained.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Every year when we have the co-lectures, we create a poster for the lectureship, and we have it framed for the speaker. Now, you do not have to carry this back on the plane. We will, in fact, ship it to you, but...
So beautiful. I admired it coming in. I didn't know I was going to get a coffee.
No, I just smiled to myself and said, oh, wait till you get to the lecture.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much, Dr. Mattson. And I invite all of you to the reading room, which is that-a-way. For refreshments, we have light hors d'oeuvres and drink. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., we'll hear the second of the co-lectures for this year. I invite you to return and bring some folk with you. Take good care, and we'll see you tomorrow.